The result has been an extreme shortage of men whose self-image and interests would have led them to the top.
Isn't that one reason, one major reason, that our technical community is in trouble today?
I think you're right. For the technical world, this is a critical time. It's a time in which the credibility, the ethics, and the value judgments of the entire technical community are questioned. It's a time when many of us are fighting to bring a higher order of professionalism into our lives. And it's not an easy fight. And we engineers are by no means united in this cause. Many of my colleagues hold that engineers must not question where the highway is to be built, or whether leaded gasoline should be prohibited, or whether an American SST will have a high social value. They think these are political questions, and they say, we don't have any professional license to involve ourselves in such discussions. It's as though they were saying, ours is not to reason why.
And many politicians and businessmen would agree with them. That's what the engineer is up against, the engineer who contends that he must involve himself. The politicians and businessmen, even some of the engineer's own professional colleagues, would prefer that these engineers be on tap, available on call as sources of narrow expertise.
I agree that that's the way a lot of people feel, but I assert the system cannot function that way. The facts are just too clear.
I believe engineers must involve themselves in social decision-making.
Well, it's professionally irresponsible to do otherwise. I believe that the engineer's credibility, his ethics, his value judgments, and above all, his capabilities are in question today because the engineers in the past have failed to be involved. Too often, technical people have waited too long or been too timid. They've lent their talents only after the important questions of human purpose have been decided and decided by others. And I don't think we can go on that way.
But involvement is not a right which the engineer must exercise. It's an obligation he has to earn.
That's true. The engineer must learn to so conduct himself that he will not only be heard, he will also be heeded. And this is a challenge both for the young engineer and for his teacher. The challenge is to pull together education in the sciences, in engineering, in the humanities, and to apply that collective knowledge in such a way that the engineer is respected. Only through this kind of action will engineers earn the right to play a responsible role in the shaping of society. This means that the engineering educators must take a look at how they are teaching their students and whether, in fact, they and their students are using the time that they have in college to learn to grapple with these problems and to pull together the education that's offered in the various parts of the university. After all, the world outside is not organized the way universities are. Problems don't come in narrow, neat little packages. They come all at once, all things wrapped up together. And somewhere in the engineering student's experience, he must have an opportunity to grapple with that kind of situation. Even if he doesn't develop a great deal of skill at it, he must learn to recognize that that is part and parcel of the engineer's task.
In our society today, technical people are largely outside the decision-making process.
Oh, that's certainly true. And you see this particularly when you look at our government. In matters of making public policy, it is disgraceful the small number of engineers who are actively involved in the setting of this policy. The voices of engineers and scientists are now even weaker in the executive branch of the federal government than they have been in almost a quarter of a century. The present administration seems ready, in fact it has, discarded the office of the President's Science Advisor, the President's Science Advisory Committee, the White House Office of Science and Technology, the whole technical apparatus that was part of the White House has been kicked out.
If Congress is alert, it's going to take advantage of this.
Yes, if they are alert. Now, the Congress recently established an Office of Technology Assessment, but we have not yet seen this agency in action, and we don't know how effective it'll be.
But Congress has needed, long needed, an independent source of technical advice and expertise.
Well, if the Congress were to create such an agency, and that agency were to conduct technical audits of the administration programs, if it were to advise senators and congressmen the right kinds of questions to ask during hearings, if it would give briefings independent of White House control, if it were to do all of these things at a time when the White House has thrown out all of its technical talent, then the coming struggle between the President and the Congress would be extremely interesting to watch. And if I were going to bet on the outcome, I'd bet on the Congress if they would take advantage of what could be done through this office they've created.
The Science Policy Research Division of the Library of Congress has issued an interesting report called Technical Information for Congress. This report identifies 15 technical issues on which the Congress was grossly misled. We both know that governmental decisions on socio-technical issues are frequently made without sufficient technical knowledge.
Well, as an example, I've already mentioned the politically inspired, and that's what it was, Clean Air Act, which everyone hoped would protect the environment, but which, in my opinion, is going to have almost the opposite effect. Many of us who worked on problems of air pollution, and we were doing this as much as 20 years ago, long before it was politically popular, viewed the stringent requirements of the Clean Air Act with a great deal of alarm.
Why with alarm?
Well, we knew there was no technology available that would meet the requirements of that act on the time scale given without either introducing extremely high costs in automobile manufacture or extremely high fuel consumption.
What was your approach?
Well, we believed that a slightly less stringent requirement would reduce the pollution more quickly because it would give time for better technology to develop to meet the more stringent standards. You see, we protested, those of us who were in the federal government and a lot of people outside of it, but the congressional proponents pushed the bill through, and then they pointed with pride with what they had done. But we're beginning to see the cost of this kind of advocacy because, as I said before, the new model automobiles use about 30% more fuel than did the cars of 1968. And this compounds the problem because not only do we have a fuel crisis, and that, whether the Arabs cut the fuel off or whether we have to pay very high prices for it, it really amounts to the same thing because we'll have a tremendous trade imbalance if we can get the fuel. But the new cars now will cost so much more to own and operate, there's a real danger that many consumers will keep their old cars much longer, and that will increase rather than decrease the pollution problem.
Let's turn now to another side of the same question, Myron, to the real danger of our age of specialists. The depth of total knowledge demanded today is enormous. It's beyond the capacity of any man, so we become a nation of specialists.
Well, this is certainly true, and that just creates a new kind of a challenge for us because it makes collaboration the key to all of this. We have to learn how to teach one another across the professions, how to learn from one another, how to advise one another. If we don't do this, we'll discover that there's a kind of an intellectual wedge driven between the specialists, especially the specialists in technical disciplines and those in law, politics, humanities, and so on. This is a real danger because it will tend to breed provincialism, ignorance, distrust. It leads to oversimplification of problems and simplified decisions. This is why the professional person needs to rise above his own narrow base. My concern is that engineers won't do this. They will be held back by a peculiar self-image that makes them feel that it's beyond their responsibility. Now, I've had the experience of working in teams with lawyers and economists, and I know that after you've worked with these fellows in a team, you can develop an ability to understand the problem from their point of view as well as your own. And through this kind of collaboration, you can take advantage of the fact that they have specialized knowledge and yet go on and deal with the general problem in all its generality. I'm really concerned about decision-making on technical matters carried out by technically illiterate people, but I don't want to call for a society run by technocrats. That would be no better, no more enlightened than the present condition. What I'm saying is this. Engineers represent a very important national asset. What the engineer chooses to do with his abilities is important beyond himself. You know, engineering is the only discipline which deliberately puts together ideas of science and human value and attempts to come up with practical, workable solutions that will be accepted. It's not easy to play the more general role. Non-technical people will look at you and say, oh, he's an engineer, and presume that because you come from an engineering background, you are not to be trusted with consideration of the big picture.
And what you're saying is that it's the young engineer's task to earn that trust.
That's right. And he has to be trusted in both directions, because as he begins to look at the big picture, some of the engineers who have remained technical specialists will try to puff up their own egos, and they'll say, oh, what can he do? You know, he's just a generalist. All he does is wave his arms at the hard technical problems. He doesn't have the technical depth to solve the problems. I do. So you have not only then to develop the trust and the confidence of non-technical people by your ability to deal with the non-technical aspects of the problem, you must also keep your expertise alive. You must remain in the technical conversations. And this becomes the challenge for the young engineer as he develops. Of course, the young engineer doesn't start at the top. And so he has time to develop his technical expertise and his breadth of perspective. His professional growth will take time, and it must be given precedence over these other responsibilities. But as he grows, so will his capabilities. And the important thing here is that his self-image should propel him in the direction of learning more than just technical things. Now, even with time, even with professional experience, the engineer will always have to live with uncertainty, because the tools that he will have available, no matter how advanced they may be at the moment, will always seem, and in fact will always be, pitifully small in comparison with the job he must do. The demands that are made on the engineer will almost always exceed the purely technical capabilities he has, and he will have to deal with problems knowing that he isn't completely in control.
So he'll always be running to the edge of the world and beyond, off into the darkness.
Yes, Dave, that quotation from St. Thomas Aquinas is a good one. It's a good one to describe the life of the engineer. Our destiny is to run to the edge of the world and beyond, off into the darkness, sure for all our blindness, secure for all our helplessness, strong for all our weakness. The early years are tough, probably no tougher than the grind of the engineering school, but they're tougher in a different way. They bring a test of will, of determination, of ability at self-motivation. If the young engineer passes this test, then his professional life is likely to be one of reward, and probably even substantial reward. He will do things later on that now would seem too difficult and beyond his capability. But if he's good, he'll grow. He'll play over his head. The young engineer today is in for some really big times and plenty of opportunity, because the world really needs his talent.
In conclusion, this is your Soundings editor, Roger W. Bowles, to say thanks to Dr. Tribus and Dave Allison for an extremely perceptive insight into the world of the young engineer today. My suggestion now is that you read the current report of the IEEE Manpower Committee entitled Career Outlook in Engineering, which delves into not only the opportunities in the entire field, but delves into many of the additional personal and technical aspects that have been touched upon so poignantly by Dr. Tribus. We wish you many challenging years of engineering ahead.
IEEE Soundings is a registered service mark of the Institute of Electrical and Electronics Engineers, New York.